Accession number 19392, Real 1.
Donald Evans, Real 1, where were you born, please?
And I reply, in Manchester.
Which year was this?
1921.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Manchester?
No, I come from Norfolk, really. I was only in Manchester about 6 months, and we had a short spell in London, and then we lived in Galston in Norfolk, and I went to school at Norwich.
Which school was that?
Edward VI, the school in the close by the cathedral.
And how old were you when you left that school?
When I left?
Yes.
17, just coming up to 18.
So that would have been in 38, 39?
Yes, that's right. I left in 39.
Just as the war was starting?
Just before the war started.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I did.
Under what circumstances?
Well, we were supposed to have a friend of mine to stay, and with this crisis, it was thought unwise for anyone to come to the coast, because we were on the coast, and it was cancelled, so we were sort of listening to the wireless. We had no commitment.
How did you feel about the news?
It's difficult to say now. I think the anxiety that my parents felt must have come on to me because they were talking of rationing in the war, and lack of coal and lack of food. The First World War, that is, lack of food and so forth. On the other hand, one felt there was a certain excitement about it. We'd seen either the Graf Zeppelin or the Hindenburg come over Yarmouth a couple of years before, and one realised that there was going to be a great deal of aerial activity, which in fact didn't transpire for quite a long time.
Had you expected a sudden air attack by the German Air Force?
Oh yes, I think everyone did. we had a shelter in the garden to which we were prepared to move. In fact, we slept there for some nights until it was obvious that they weren't going to do this. They weren't going to attack. If I remember rightly, my father was a headmaster of a school for blind and deaf children. And quite shortly afterwards, the school was transferred to Wales because it was considered in a dangerous area. So that I went into digs, because at that time I was an article pupil to a civil engineer.
Whereabouts was that?
That was in Yarmouth. In Yarmouth. And stayed in digs for the time I was an article pupil, which was a 3-year period, which was from 1939 to 1942, when at the end of my article pupil, I was then went to Norwich and took the King's Shilling.
So the first 3 years of the war, you were living in Great Yarmouth?
That's right.
What was life like in Great Yarmouth?
Well, it was curiously both peaceful and unpeaceful. I mean, that sounds absurd, but in fact there were very few people there. Large numbers of people had been evacuated. Certainly after the fall of Holland, and the place, I wouldn't say it was anything like deserted, but certainly it was very small, relatively small number of people. On the other hand, we had a series of raids, generally speaking by one or two aircraft, nothing saturation like Coventry and that sort, and the Baedeker raids, and of course the raids in on London. These were mostly individual aircraft coming in very low. They used to come in low, fly up the river, which runs parallel to the coast, about a quarter of a mile inland from the coast. And I remember once going down to the ARP place, because we were involved in ARP. And there at the end of the road was the river, and along the river was a flying a Dornier 217, I think it is, a long, thin, pencil-like thing. That's vividly in my memory. It was spraying the ships with gun, with machine gun fire.
With much effect?
Very unsettling effect, I think. People said, you know, where are the anti-aircraft guns? Well, of course, in point of fact, the anti-aircraft guns were at London. Very rightly so, too. But people didn't quite see it that way. And the ships, which were mostly armed trawlers and that sort of thing, they fired away. I don't recall any enemy aircraft being brought down.
How much damage was done in Yarmouth?
Well, compared with the intense raids that there were in places like East End of London, not a lot, but it was fairly widely spread, and it was continuous. That was the trying part, that you never knew when the next... Well, obviously you didn't know when the next raid was coming, but you could be fairly sure that it wouldn't be all that long away. And by that I mean perhaps 2 or 3 raids a week. I suppose that's the sort of order. And then some nights you'd have whole sequence of raids, where largely when they were going over to the Midlands, and I suppose if they either got diverted or lost the will to press on, they'd come back and drop bombs on the coastal towns, Yarmouth, Lowestoft and so forth.
What was your address at that time?
I lived up at, golly, I've forgotten, Poplar Avenue. I was in digs in Poplar Avenue, which is the very south end of Galston, the Galston Yarmouth complex. So we had no bombs actually near our house, but of course, being a trainee civil engineer, we were deeply into the ARP and the rescue squads and so forth, so we went down to the depots and worked on that.
What did your ARP and rescue squad work involve?
Well, basically, digging people out. Shoring up buildings so they didn't fall on the rescuers. You know, it was all a bit ad hoc. And then ultimately demolishing the buildings if they were in danger.
What do you use for the digging?
Hands, buckets, shovels, picks, that sort of thing. With very little mechanical equipment. And the reason for that was not necessarily that it wasn't available, though it probably wasn't, but in point of fact, it lacked the fine tuning that you needed to lift stuff off if you were going to get people out of the wreckage. I don't think mechanical equipment would have been at all suitable.
Were people injured doing this job?
Oh, yes. Do you mean the rescuers?
Yes.
Oh, yes, sometimes things fell on people and so forth. I don't know how many casualties. I just have no idea at all how many casualties we had among the rescuers. Not all that number, but they weren't unknown.
Were you injured yourself?
No.
Do you remember any incidents?
Yes, I do. There was a... can't remember the name of the road... but it was in Yarmouth, not far from St. George's Church in Yarmouth, and there were a stick of bombs had gone across, landing in this particular case on some terraced houses, or, yeah, I think they were terraced houses, might have been semi-detached houses, nothing pretend, you know, quite small, and unpretentious. It so happened I knew... the people in that one house that had been killed, which was rather unpleasant.
What was the attitude to the German air crews who were carrying out the bombing?
I think the easiest way to describe it would be, say, defiance. You know, if you do this, you think you're going to... As Churchill said, what sort of a people do they think we are?
Did you ever come across anybody who wanted to give in to them?
Never. Never once.
Did public morale stand up?
I believe it did in our area. Whether it did in the intensively bombed areas such as the East End of London, I couldn't say. One has heard subsequently that morale was beginning to crack. I can well believe it. I mean, I can well understand. Sorry, I don't mean I can well believe it. I can well understand it if it was, but there was certainly never any hint of that. And obviously, any feeling that the will to resist was being eroded wouldn't be disseminated. I mean, I wouldn't say suppressed, but certainly that would never receive publicity. But by and large, I think the answer was, as I say, defiance.
Would you take shelter during the raid?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Pretty well everyone did. You know, there'd be some wardens about, sort of just checking that there was nobody about, but everyone went into shelters, one sort or another. The Anderson shelter, which was a sort of corrugated iron job covered with earth, were very common in back gardens. And then there was a thing called a Morrison shelter, which is like a huge steel table, and you put it inside the house. And then there were a number of reinforced brick shelters built in the streets. They weren't so good, because if you've got a bomb near them, they tended to collapse. But certainly everyone went into shelter.
Did you know of any brick shelters that did collapse?
Yes, I do. I knew a chap who was in one, a chap named Percy Smoten. And the bomb sucked out the walls, and the concrete roof came down and squashed all the people inside.
Where was that?
That was in Yarmouth. I can't actually define exactly where it was in Yarmouth, but... this chap, Percy Smoten, was a chap I knew in it.
Did you travel about? Did you go to Norwich and other places?
No. One didn't. Actually, travelling about was jolly difficult. First of all, there was no petrol. So buses seemed to run, but certainly there were very, very few cars. And also, there wasn't much point in travelling anywhere else. I did travel to Wales to see my parents in the school they were evacuated to, but apart from that... Oh, and I went to London once or twice to sit exams for my Institution of Civil Engineers... progressing through the institution.
What impression did London under the Blitz make on you?
Not a lot, because when on the time, I mean, you'd only go for 2 days, you know, 2 days exams and do your papers and off you go back again. And there were no, when I was there, I didn't have any raids at all. I mean, raids, one mustn't forget that there weren't everyday raids on London, you know, those spells. I'm not able to tell you about that. I'm sure there are lots of people who can give you a much better view of what was happening in London, but certainly on the days I went there, we stayed at the Regent Palace Hotel in just by Piccadilly Circus. If I remember rightly, it was 10 and 6 a night. For the 2 nights of the exams, and then home we went.
Now, can you tell me about joining the army, please?
Yes. When I'd finished my articles, which is in the middle of 1942. I then was employed for a short while, still as a civil engineer, unqualified in the sense that I wasn't a corporate member of the Institution of Civil Engineers, but I had done my training, so was sort of moving up the ladder slowly. And then I think the trigger was a friend of mine had joined up. So I thought, well, I'll do this. And I think I would like to go into the Navy. We had E-boats off the coast, and we had motor torpedo boats and motor gunboats in Yarmouth, and it all looked exciting stuff. So I went to the recruiting office in Norwich, which I can't now identify where it was, but the chap said, they won't have you in the Navy because you've trained as a civil engineer, straight away into the Royal Engineers. So I said, well, that was all right by me. I don't suppose I had much choice. I said, that was all right by me. So he gave me the form, a foolscap form, which had all sorts of things on it, and you took an oath to obey the generals and officers set over you and all that sort of, you know, the standard thing. And if I remember rightly, maybe this is a fiction of my imagination, I think I actually did get the King's Shilling for joining. But I can't swear to that. Certainly I got this form. And then in due course, I was called up and went to Chatham Kitchener Barracks, which were really frightfully mid-Victorian at that time, and did recruit training. The thing I remember about Kitchener Barracks, two things I remember. One is that in the morning when you shaved, they were in the ablutions, pardon me, in the ablutions there were slate slabs. I suppose it must have been difficult to tell, 12, 15 feet long, over which were a number of cold taps. And under the taps were aluminium basins, and you filled the basin and you washed and shaved and pitched it down the back. There was no hot water, and it was really fairly basic. The other thing I remember was the food, or the arrangements for getting the food, because we were issued with two mess tins which fitted into each other, knife, fork and spoon. That was the standard issue. Now, once you'd been there a few days, you quickly realised that the essential element that was missing was a mug. Because when you went, for example, for breakfast, you got a mess tin full of tea. The other mess tin then had to take porridge at one end and a sausage or a fried bread or something at the other end, which tended to coalesce, which didn't improve certainly their visual appearance, and not particularly their taste. So you got a mug, and then after that you were able to have your porridge in one mess tin, your fried breakfast and the other mess tin, and have the tea in the mug.
Any other memories from Kitchener Barracks?
Oh, yes. We had a Sergeant Murray who, according to his opinion, had never had in all his life a more incompetent, useless crowd of recruits than the ones that we had at that time. And we went through rifle drill time and time again. Up 2-3, down 2-3. And so I think we must have been fairly good at it. We did various other things. We crawled about. But it was all very basic training until one went to pre-optu at Rootham.
Had you coped with what was expected of you at Kitchener?
I beg your pardon?
Had you coped with everything that was expected of you at Kitchener?
Oh, I think so. You were all very enthusiastic to make a good fist of it, and one laid out one's kit and blankets and so forth in the approved way. I think everyone was determined, you know, to make a fist of it. Then we were into Rootham, which I think that was the pre-optu, which must have had as its objective sorting the sheep from the goats, because it really was a barbaric regime. Things I remember there: filling ammunition boxes with soil and dragging them up hills, ostensibly to reinforce a unit on the top of the hill, dragging these things up, then dragging them back again. Rootham is quite hilly. There's an escarpment, I think, at Rootham. And we dragged these things up and down, and we marched and marched. And the other thing, which was amusing but not particularly pleasant, they didn't have separate WCs. What they had was a large diameter glazed stoneware pipe with a piece at the top, which was obviously intended when the pipe was made that you fitted another pipe in so that it was a junction. But these were in a row of perhaps 6 or 8 or 10 of these things with a little partition between each and an open front, and you sat on these when you wanted to go to the loo. And there was a tank at the top, and it flushed through every few minutes or 5 minutes or however. But of course, some genius found a way of extracting amusement from these, because just as it was about to flush, you could tell it sort of made a gurgle noise, you'd scrumple up some paper, newspaper, pop it in the loo, and light it. And when the tank flushed, it ran this down and scorched everyone's backside. This was thought hilariously funny.
And what other things were you expected to learn apart from dragging ammunition boxes around?
Oh, it was a sort of toughening up process. There's no question about it. And indeed, by the time we finished there, we were jolly fit. They did other. I mean, that's just one thing. But other things, things, the effect of dead ground on distance and concealment and platoon drill and that sort of thing, with a rifle group and a brand group moving round to attack a position, that sort of thing we were doing now.
And next?
And then we went to TBRE, the OCTU at Newark, where we did a 30-week course divided into various bits. The first 6-7 weeks were infantry training. We were enjoined that we had to be efficient fighting sapper officers, and the emphasis in that bit was on the fighting bit. So we did infantry training. We went to the School of Infantry at Llanberis in North Wales. And that was the battle school at the end of this 6 weeks, 1 week's battle school. And back at Newark, we did various attacks and defences and withdrawals and things called TEUTs, tactical exercises without troops, where you go on and a scenario would be put to you by the directing staff, and you had to come up with answers and so forth. And then as the last week, we went to the battle school, which involved climbing over mountains, attacking across Lake Ogwin. I don't know where that is, but that's the name that sticks in my mind. The idea was that we were going to attack across it in boats, folding boats, which are sort of standard sapper equipment. But in point of fact, we didn't. We attacked across it in foot because it was solid ice, which rather screwed up the directing staff's plans, but it made it a bit easier. And then we did a fighting attack down a valley, that sort of thing. All infantry stuff. After that, we then went on, and this isn't necessarily in the right order, we went on to bridging with Bailey Bridging. The Engels Bridge was just going out then, the Bailey was in general use. And then we did wet bridging using pontoons, folding boat equipment, which is sort of class 9 sort of flexible bridging, unlike a Bailey, which was rigid and either between pontoons, this sort of flexed as a vehicle went over it.
Class 9, you said?
Pardon? Class 9, which in other words, it was for vehicles, not for armour. The Bailey, depending on what you were doing, the Bailey, of course, would take armour. Then we did mining, lifting mines, putting mines down. And indeed, only a little while ago, I found my notebook on how to do it.
How do you do it?
Putting down mines. Well, you put out tapes. And it's a fairly complex business of having chaps going forward, and they stagger them so that everyone isn't beside, so if something goes wrong you don't lose everybody. And rather similar for mine lifting, where you probe for these mines with bayonet, you crawl along and probe and lift them up and take them to the side. But it's rather a more complex business than is easy to explain on a tape. What else did we do there? Oh, we did law. The standard thing. The chap throws down his musket and says, "I will soldier no more." What do you do then?
What do you do?
We put him on a charge for, and unless there are more than one, then it's mutiny.
What are you supposed to do if it's mutiny?
Pardon? Well, you get the, if you've got the means, you arrest them. If you haven't, you have to go off and find means and arrest them. But though you might, I must say, in all my experience, I never had anything like that. You might have chaps griping, which is their prerogative, and it's your duty to sort of defuse the gripes. But, various things. You know, he loses equipment, and you bring him up before the OC, and who then finds him the cost of the equipment. He loses his socks or something.
Are you advised to be severe or lenient?